like basically how difficult the situation that we are all in is, and how that is kind of a parallel to maybe Aaron's situation. That Aaron is experiencing hard times, and yet he's quiet. And how are we supposed to react? So with that, I'll open it up. Anybody have any thoughts about what are some ways that we all react to quarantine and also kind of the sadness of the world outside us, where we're seeing an uptick in deaths and we're seeing people who are passing away? And how are we reacting to that? What are reactions that are normal and healthy, and what are reactions that are maybe less normal and less healthy?
I can't answer your question, but I have a question.
Yeah.
I'm struggling a little bit with about gaining glory before all the people. That something doesn't sit right with me about that language. You know, especially prefaced with "I show myself holy."
Right.
Do you really gain glory when you're showing yourself as holy? I mean, even if you're Hashem, I mean, you know.
Yeah, it's a really nice point. That whole line, I kind of skipped over it mentally because it's so potentially troubling, of trying to figure out what Moses is trying to express to Aaron and why it has any relevance in this moment when his two eldest sons have died. And yeah, Sharon's saying something. I don't know how well you guys can hear her. Go ahead.
Perhaps God is reflecting and saying to his people something, that if in order to come to heaven and attain your holiness, you've got
it's just on earth.
Develop your character in a more wholesome, holy fashion.
Maybe in order to, right, what Sharon said is, in maybe in order to get closer to God, we all have to kind of be more cautious in order to get closer to God. Is that, that's my best understanding of what you were saying, Sharon. Not everybody can hear you, so I have to kind of repeat. And Richard just joined us, so thank you, Richard, for bearing with us with the technical difficulties. Any other thoughts? Sabina, I think you wanted to say something, right?
Going back to when Aaron was silent, when you were saying, and he was praised for this, he kind of like held it together when he might have been very, very angry.
Yeah.
He didn't show the anger.
Yeah. And I think that's a valid point and a really interesting one, which is that, like, we don't have a lot of... we don't have a lot of proper ways of reacting. Also, just the understanding, you know, in Judaism, when we mourn, typically we kind of let the mourner do what the mourner's going to do, right? You know, extreme showings of grief and extreme silence, all of it is considered, you know, normal from a pastoral and rabbinic perspective. And also, if you walk into a house of Shiva and everybody's distraught, you kind of accept that. We all kind of understand that. And if you walk into a house of Shiva and people are saying, well, it's a celebration of life, and everybody's kind of, you know, telling jokes and being jovial, then we accept that too. We kind of understand that people grieve in different ways. People remember in different ways.
So go ahead. I kind of remember that Aaron was forbidden to mourn. And I'm not sure if that is from, you know, Torah texts or commentary, but essentially he was not allowed to mourn his sons. And that's the memory I have of what goes on with this parsha.
Yeah, it's unclear whether, it seems to be a commentary that he was silent because he was supposed to be, because he's supposed to be silent, versus he's silent because he decided to be silent, right? And so I think you could play it either way. I think it's a standard rabbinic commentary that he was supposed to be quiet, that God would have punished him had he not been quiet. But the text doesn't explicitly say that. So it's interesting. Joe, go ahead, and then we'll do the text since we don't have a whole ton of time.
I want to
a point about the text is that these were supposedly Moses' nephews. The other thing I wanted to point out, with respect to the question, what are some reactions to difficult times? What I want to tell the group is that I've been tracking the coronavirus data for over a month now, and today we only had 11 new cases recorded, and the numbers are going down. We're at about 10% of our peak, so that is excellent news. It's going to be over tomorrow or next week or even next month. Life has changed for a year, give or take.
Yeah, thanks. So I think moving forward, I hope all you can see the text again. Yes, just nod your head. Mm-hmm. So moving forward, the question of like how we grieve and how we deal with even quarantine, you know, how we deal with what is a difficult time of being in quarantine, is a concept addressed by the Kotzker Rebbe Menachem Mendel of Kotzk, who there's this story here about this guy who visited him. So here's the story. Rabbi Lipman of Radomsk, the son-in-law of the Tiferet Shlomo, the first Radomsk Rebbe, came to Kotzk. The Rebbe of Kotzk, Menachem Mendel, asked him if he could give a Dvar Torah in the name of his father-in-law. The son-in-law said, "Our sages extol the miracle of the silence of Aaron upon the death of his sons Nadav and Abihu. Rashi quotes the Midrash and brings that Aaron said that he received divine merit for his silence. What was the merit? That God alone spoke to Aaron, that God taught him alone the section regarding intoxication with wine." So this is Rashi's comment, that the Midrash says Aaron receives a reward. This is to kind of answer Sabina's question. It's not that he was going to be punished if he spoke, but on the contrary, he received reward for being silent, that being silent is somehow praiseworthy. And the question is, what is praiseworthy? If you go forward to verse 10:8, so feel free to look this up in a Tanakh right now or on your computer. If you go forward to verse 10:8, it says, "And God spoke to Aaron, saying," and then God gives Aaron some advice, which is pretty uncommon, right? In the Torah, God generally spoke to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Moses. That's it. Nobody else gets special one-to-one God time. And here we get a moment in which Aaron gets face-to-face speaking to God time. So that's the reward. So the commentary continues. However, even greater is what was said by King David. And the implication here is that King David speaks face-to-face to God also. And he quotes the Psalms. And the Psalms say this, "Laman yizamercha kavod velo yidom." This is Psalm 30. "That my whole being might sing hymns to you and not be silent, O Lord my God. I will praise you forever." And the son-in-law, the rabbi of Radomsk, continues, "Even in intense suffering and pain, he continued to sing to God and was not silent." And then the Kotzker rabbi replies to this Dvar Torah, "Yes, a wonderful thing," said the Kotzker. So we have two modes here of accepting suffering. Mode one is silence, right? Aaron being silent while seeing something painful, which is the death of his sons. And version two, which is a little strange, is King David. And King David sings in response to suffering. And that's, if you look here, I gave you Psalm 30. "Psalm of David, a song for the dedication of the house. I extol you, Lord, for you lifted me up." Line three, O Lord my God, I cried out to you and you healed me." If you go all the way down to verse 10, you get this line, "What is to be gained from my death, from my descent into the pit? Can dust praise you? Can it declare your faithfulness?" And then you get 12. You turned my lament into dancing. You undid my sackcloth and girded with my joy. And then finally, this line, final line that we have before, "That my whole being might sing praises, hymns to you and not be silent. O Lord, my God, I will praise you forever." So somehow the Radomsk Rebbe reads all this and says, so David was dealing with suffering, and he uses it as a moment to talk about singing praise to God. Aaron experiences suffering, which is the death of his sons, and he chooses silence. And the Kotzker, his response to all this is, it is good and praiseworthy, potentially, to not only respond to difficulty with song and praise, it may be better than what Aaron does. And I think it's just an interesting moment of pause to kind of think about difficult times and ways of responding to them. That I think a lot of us think it is normal and healthy to become sad and depressed. And I think that is true and normal and healthy to accept that suffering is a time in human life where we should be okay being sad. But there's a second response, which is being yidom, being silent, which is what Aaron does, vayidom aharon. And then there's a third response, which is the response of King David, which is to say velo yidom and not be silent, but rather Adonai Elohai le'olam odeka, that I will always praise the Lord my God in that moment. It's a thing we do in Judaism when we hear about the death of an individual, Baruch Dayan HaEmet, blessed be the true judge, that we're praising God in this moment, even though it's kind of contrary to what we might want to do. We might not feel comfortable praising God. We may want instead to curse God or even to be silent because we are so heartbroken, right? This is a moment in our American society where we see great suffering and people in New York who are lamenting and mourning. And it might be a moment where we should be angry with God or where we should be silent and feel distant from God. And King David's response is, let's take this moment to be thankful of God for the moments that we have. I think Rich has his hand up.
Yeah, my virtual hand. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, why should we be pleased that Aaron is acquiescing in the death of his sons? So shouldn't he be speaking out against it at the very least?
Right. I think that's a legitimate problem. And it's always bothered me that it's a very easy thing, I think, in this text to say, you know, I don't know that it's praiseworthy to accept injustice. And I don't have a great answer. I mean, I think the simple answer is you're right. The rabbinic answer is to do what the rabbis do, which is the rabbis never really, very rarely look at the Torah and say, the Torah is an example of injustice and wrongness. It can't be right, right? They don't have that mode in them. They have to understand if this is a divine text, then how do I take it and make meaning of it? So what the rabbis typically do in this text is they do mental backflips in order to understand what Aaron's son did as being profoundly wrong and that they should have known better and that their death was justified, which is hard for us as moderns to accept because they don't seem to be doing anything profoundly wrong. And understanding deaths as divinely just is always hard for us as moderns. Sabina and then Marilyn, go ahead.
So in reading the part about King David and the singing and the dancing, I couldn't help but recall one of the most memorable and heartbreaking movies I had ever seen. It was an Israeli film called My Father, My King. Are other people on the line familiar with it? It's essentially a very overly zealous rabbi who has a young son, and the young son goes to the little shtiebel with him and is always there and he's bored and, you know, the father ignores him. And there is a, it might have been a Lag BaOmer outing where they go to the seashore. And it's time to daven mincha, I believe. And, you know, the rabbi gathers the men together and they're not paying attention to the children and the child drowns. And, you know, they go through the initial mourning period and the movie ends with the first and bury the child. And the husband rabbi is, it's just him and his wife at their table, and he is singing Zemiris, and she won't join him. And he yells at her, "You're supposed to be joyous. It's Shabbos. Mm. You cannot let the sadness overtake you." And I think I saw this movie maybe 15 or 20 years ago, but I've never forgot it.
Right.
Yeah.
It was an amazing film.
Yeah. Marilyn, go ahead.
And to kind of build off a little bit of what Sabina just said, what struck me is that I can understand silence in the sense of Aaron knows his sons have done something wrong, and so he can't blame God. But Aaron has lost his sons, and to deprive him of the opportunity to express his grief strikes me as so wrong. You know, to interpret this as the, it's the end, it, it, for me, it's the antithesis, because there is this, this, not only the sense that children are a gift, but the relationship between parent and child is very, very strong. And so even, so you acknowledge that maybe your child did something, you know, just think as a corollary today of all the parents struggling with children with addictions, for example, but they are still your children and you get frustrated and sometimes there's nothing you can do because they're adults, but that doesn't mean you don't grieve. And grief needs an expression, whether it's Psalms, you know, such as David did, or even just a simple cry, but not a condemnation. I understand that he shouldn't condemn. I don't understand why he's not allowed to grieve.
Yeah, go ahead, Joe.
I have a different track on this. When I first read it, it was, well, Moses is talking to Aaron, but I read it as Aaron was silent because of what God had done. But now on rereading it, Moses is the meaning. He's the meaning. Aaron, you know, you're stupid. How could you let this happen? And it's Aaron who is silent because of what Moses said. He's aghast. How could you say this to me when I've just lost my sons and you've lost your nephews?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so where am I going here? So Moses is not allowed, God does not allow Moses in the promised land. And we don't really know why. There's a lot of speculation. I've never heard this particular sentence being the reason for Moses not being allowed into the promised land. But Moses clearly overstepped his authority here.
I agree.
Is saying what he said, especially not immediately after the death.
I love that answer. I've never heard
rivalry.
I've never heard that interpretation before, and I really like it. That somebody.
You're not going to believe this, Joe, but I agree with you 100%.
So do I.
Yeah.
I'm impressed.
Good job, Joe.
I'm impressed that someone actually agrees with me.
100%.
Even me.
Topic.
Even that's what's impressive.
I might write that down and claim it for my own. No. Good one. Any other reflections on this text? I definitely think that the basic idea that's put forth here is one that you guys challenge in a way that I really like, which is that our rabbis, the way they respond to it by saying, well, there are other reactions to suffering, didn't satisfy you because at the end you were ultimately frustrated with the first moment of even the death itself. And I think that there's another way of looking at that, which is, we sometimes as humans question the righteousness of a death at all, and whether it's fair, and whether and how frustrating it is. And one way of looking at this is to say, you know, Aaron has a reaction to a death, and David has a reaction to a death, but the reality is neither of them can affect it, right? They can't bring that person back from the dead, right? And so when we don't have the capacity to change the way the universe works, we are left with, all we can do is manage our own reaction to it, right? I can't make the coronavirus go away, and I can't bring people back who died of it, but I'm only in control of what I'm in control of, and what I'm in control of is my emotional reaction to it. So I can choose to be sad, I can choose to be happy, I can choose to sing, I can choose to be silent, and those are all legitimate reactions. I just got a message from Zoom that they're not closing the meeting. Oh, you all got it. Great.
Yeah.
So that's good news. You guys can all chat about what we're having for lunch afterwards anyways. good. Any other, go ahead, Sabina. And then since our time is extended, I'll give you the two bonus texts anyways, since they're more uplifting anyways.
So kind of paralleling what happens to Job, where all these horrible things happens to him and he's restrained from cursing God and is later rewarded.
Nice. And that's, again, it's very much like Aaron, which is he is not obligated. The text seems to believe that he is, if he curses God, God will punish him by killing him. And that would be the preferable outcome. But Job chooses not to. And so it's in Job's hands to decide what to do. And he makes that choice. All right, we're gonna move forward and do the next two texts. They're short, don't worry, but they're on a slightly different section in our text. So the next two sections of our, the next section is from Leviticus 11, which is like two chapters later, and it's on keeping kosher. And we get this very simple line, which is V'kol ha'olech al kapav v'al kol ha'chaya ha'cholechet al arba tme'im hem lachem kol hanogea benivlotam yitma ad ha'arev. So also, all animals that walk on paws and all that walk on fours are unclean to you. Whoever touches their carcasses shall be unclean until evening. So this is after a chapter before we find out what animals are kosher. And then the basic implication here is, if I didn't already mention a hoofed ungulate that chews its cud, you may not eat it. And so we've got a fairly repetitive text, right? We kind of already knew this, right? If it's got paws, you can't eat it. So our rabbis jump in to ask a question about it. So Rabbi Simcha Bunim of Pshischa, one of our favorites, jumps in and says this: there are those that perform the commandments with only their hands, without head or heart, without brain or cognition, but rather out of habit or inertia. Commandments that are trained into a person have the character of all that go about on their hands. So Simcha Bunim is making a very radical flip. He's taking the literal of keeping kosher and animals that go about on their hands and flipping it to a completely metaphorical take about people who do mitzvot with their hands, people who kind of, they just do the commandments out of rote, right? I keep kosher, I say prayers in synagogue, I put on my tefillin, I put up a sukkah, but I don't really internalize any of it. I'm just kind of going through the motions, right? The person who goes through the motions in life, he says they are tamei, they are unclean, that we need to take time to internalize commandments, to find ways of putting our head and our heart into the commandments, to like really cogitate on them and do them not by rote. I thought that was really nice. That doing commandments is and fulfilling God's word is about really taking it in deeply. The final text I'll bring you guys this today. HaHolech, this one's a fun one and a little weird, but you know I like to bring you the weird ones. Kol HaHolech al Gachon, v'kol HaHolech al Arba, ad kol HaMarbe Reglaim, l'kol HaSheret HaShoretz al HaAretz, lo tochlu ki shkotzhem. So for those of you who are hearing the word shkotz and wondering, this is the root of the word shegetz and shiksa. The origin of those two Yiddish words is that they are creepy crawlies, things that crawl around, kind of unclean, gross things, which is why it's not so nice to call someone a shegetz or a shiksa. And I try and refrain from using them because the origin of those words, even if Julia Louis-Dreyfus makes some funny jokes about shiksa peel in Seinfeld, the origin of the word shiksa is not so nice. I think we can take that word and elevate it to a nice concept, but nonetheless, I think in its origins, there's nothing nice about calling someone a shiksa. So anyways, the English here is this. You shall not eat among all the things that swarm upon the earth, anything that crawls upon its belly, or anything that walks on all fours, or anything that has many legs, for they are an abomination. So the shot of this text is, you know, you can't eat creepy crawlies, no snakes, no lizards. If it's creepy crawly, you can't eat it. So Menachem Mendel of Kotzk, who was the student of, who was the teacher of Simcha Bunim of Pshislika, our previous text, says this. He's going to do something really wild with this. Kol haholech al gachon. He says, this point in the Torah, this moment in the Torah, is the midpoint of all the letters. So there's a midrash, if you scroll down, you can see this. There's a midrash in Talmud Kedushin 30 that says, maybe you can't see it, depends how what's on your screen. There's a midrash in Kedushin 30 that says, the vav in the word gichon that we just saw above, that is the exact middle point of the Torah. So what can you do with this? What's going on here? Why is that interesting? So first of all, a qualification before we move any forward. That's not literally true. If you look at my note at the bottom, there are 302,805 letters in the Torah. The Vav in Gihon is actually letter 157,236, but not the middle point, which would really be 152,403. However, there's a commentary that I found online that explains this better. There are 17 letters in the Torah that are either extra big or extra small when they're written in a Sefer Torah. So you are probably familiar with the Ayin and the Dalet in Shema, which if you write them in a Sefer, if you see them in a Sefer Torah, the Ayin and the Dalet are larger. There are some other letters in the Torah that are smaller. The Vav and Gichon is one of them. It's slightly smaller. It's a miniature letter. There are 17 letters like that in the Torah. And of those 17 letters, the ninth one, the middle letter, is the Vav and Gichon, right? So kind of a fun idea here that kind of flips it up. So anyways, long story short, Menachem Mendel of Kotzk is going to riff on this idea of the Vav and Gichon being the middle of the Torah. Like, what's going on here with the Vav and Gichon being the middle of the Torah? And the answer is this. On one's belly, a person must rely with extra reliance, the word Gichon meaning belly, that one does not proceed from the midst of Torah, from the middle of the Torah, i.e. this middle point that we're at, filled with haughtiness for their acquired learning, boasting that they are corpulent individuals for whom much Torah has already been consumed. What does he mean by this? I'll say it a little bit differently. We have studied up to halfway in this class, and also in general in our lives, through the Torah. And we could very much easily say, look at how much Torah I have learned. I am so sacred and holy and knowledgeable. I have attended Rabbi Goodman's class every single week for the last 26 weeks, and I'm filled with Torah. Oh, pat me on the back. I'm so knowledgeable and such a good individual. And he says, you haven't filled your belly, right? That's the move that he's making here, the pun that he's kind of making. Just like the middle word in all of Torah is the word Gihon, but it's only halfway from studying through the entire Torah, so too are we, right? We have only filled our bellies halfway up with Torah. There's still another half of the Torah left to fill our bellies. So we might think that we filled our bellies with Torah, but we've only half filled our bellies, and we've only gone halfway through the Torah to this point. Go ahead, Sabina.
And your belly is halfway on your body. It's the middle.
Nice. Another one that's really nice there is that you're halfway through. You're halfway through your body. Very nice. To that point, okay, Joe, and then I got one more text, and then we'll conclude. Go ahead, Joe.
So what about or anything that walks on fours? You shall not eat anything that walks on fours.
No, that's not what it says.
He says anything that walks on kapav, on hands. That's the one above. But he also says, you're right here that he says, v'kol ha'ochlech al arba. So this is clearly in response to the earlier part. So one couldn't, if you're looking, Joe's asking a very pshat question, like what does this literally mean? And the answer that our commentators in the Torah understand from this is, anything that crawls on the ground on its belly, i.e. a snake, also anything that crawls on its belly but also has four hands, right? A skink, a lizard, anything else that's like low to the ground is not kosher. And that's kind of the way our tradition understands this concept. It has no implication regarding the study of Torah, though. You can study Torah on all fours if you like. Go ahead, Sabina. You have another question?
Yeah, there's supposed to be two species of locusts that are kosher.
Right. So,
and of course, it's always going to be the one that wipes out all the crops.
Yeah, that's coming up. There's another verse. I think it's a couple verses. It's either 10 verses before or 10 or 2 verses after this that talks about bugs. We're not up. This line
is swarm.
Yeah, but it also appears somewhere else. Yeah.
Okay.
So the basic question is, this verse seems to be mostly about lizards and snakes. There's another verse that deals with bugs and crawling things and winged things and swarming things. But it also mentions, like you said, there's a type of locust that we are permitted to eat. Me and Iggy talked about this the other day, and he was like, are you really going to eat bugs? And I was like, I don't know. It sounds pretty cool to me. All right, last line. So this whole text that Menachem Mendel of Kotzk brought about, you know, not being haughty, having learned a lot of Torah because we're only halfway there, is referenced in Pirkei Avot. So there's a line in Pirkei Avot, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai used to say, if you have learned much Torah, do not claim credit for yourself, because for such a purpose were you created, right? The whole purpose of the world is to study lots of Torah. So I thought that this idea of like going on your belly was a nice related concept. All right, with that, I hope you guys have a Zissin Pesach. Eat lots of matzah. You only have 36 more hours for which there are mitzvah points to be accrued. Fill your belly with matzah if it will not do terrible things to your digestive tract. I'm going to turn off the recording now. If you'd like to chat about what you're having for lunch and all the other things, you can do that. And I'll keep the meeting open for a little while longer, okay?